So what do we hear when I read aloud from letters composed by 17th century mercantile traders stationed on the West African coast? Employed by England's Royal African Company in satellite forts along the coast, these authors write to the company headquarters at Cape Coast Castle to send monthly accounts of their trading activity and to request that the company supply them provisions, goods, and human labor. I ask that you listen to the literary qualities of the excerpts I will read. These qualities are particular to the form of the first-person letter, also known as epistolary form. In my first passage, the director or factor of a trading outpost apologizes for the physical condition of his missive. We must beg your worship to excuse our not sealing this letter, for we have neither wax nor paper, wafers, which we hope you will be pleased to supply us with, as likewise with some paper. The author of this letter stresses the resources requisite to its composition and pleads for further supply of those materials. A text whose referential field includes the paper and wax that comprise its physical existence. This letter anticipates a defining attribute of epistolary form when it achieved mass popularity in England with the publication of Samuel Richardson's novel Pamela in 1741. And you can see it's a series of letters. So it's a novel written in letters. Another excerpt from the Royal African Company archive proceeds. I had neither ink nor paper, but only this one sheet, perchance, and am forced to write with gunpowder steeped in water, so desire to be excused for this foul page. For those who have read Robinson Crusoe, you may recognize in this author's expedient the scenario Crusoe encounters when he tries to keep a journal. Of course, as Crusoe narrates, his own ink began to fail me. For Crusoe, as well as for this Royal African Company writer, epistolary self-reference can be sustained for only as long as the writer conserves the physical medium of its existence. Just as the first-person epistle refers to the material necessity of paper and ink, so the physicality of the epistolary text extends to the state of the body that writes. Your honor indeed may wonder at my silence, which indeed hath been occasioned by sickness, and also per a sting of scorpion on my right hand, which I could not till this day hold a pen in my hand, else I had not been negligent in performing my duty. Here we can appreciate two crucial aspects of epistolary form. First, the temporal immediacy of its reference to the present tense, which Richardson called writing to the moment, whereby the letter narrates events occurring at almost the same moment the author writes. And second, the intimate connection of the body of the writer to the body of the letter. In his popular epistolary novel, Clarissa, Richardson represents the physical and mental breakdown of his epistolary protagonist, Clarissa, who is the author of the letters. He sets lines of type at an angle, thus simulating the material continuity of her disordered body and mind and the disordered text she produces. And yet, as you already know, the passages I cite are not literary fiction. They were produced by servants of England's Royal African Company, or RAC, as I will call it frequently, RAC, or Royal African Company, which was chartered in 1662 by King Charles II as a mercantile joint stock company designed to monopolize profits to England from the West African trade. Written by factors or governors at West African forts, factories, settlements, and ships to company headquarters at Cape Coast, the RAC letters are preserved as copies in three volumes contained in the Rawlinson Manuscript Collection at the Bodleian Library at Oxford University. So these are not the original letters, they're copies, obviously, they're in one book. As a royal monopoly, the RAC claimed the authority of the crown to impose absolute juridical discipline upon company employees, thus reflecting a method of state regulation of the economy based upon the constitutional validity and power of the royal prerogative. Composed from 1666 to 1699, at least in this archive, the RAC missives track the circulation of goods, including bonded and enslaved people, along the West African coast. So my talk today is structured in two parts. In part one, I discuss the problem of the historical archive of slavery, as it has been posed by African American theorists and historians Hortense Spillers and Sadia Hartman. I propose that the RAC letters, which have never before been examined in the field of literary studies, demand a new approach, that we must, as a kind of literary historical experiment, consider what these letters teach us about the archive of slavery when we read them as examples of epistolary form, so to speak, avant la lettre, before novels composed in letter form emerged in the 18th century literary public sphere. I propose that attention to the formal dimension of the RAC letters reorients our approach to the English and European archive of slavery, whose core problematic concerns its failure to recognize the subjectivity or humanity of persons who are enslaved. In part two of my talk, I discuss credit relations and the commoditization of persons in the West African trade. I suggest that the entrance of West African persons into the mercantile sphere of circulatory value or exchange value did not necessarily result in these persons' complete abstraction into commodities. To make the latter claim, I examine the figure of the pawn, or legage, an English or West African person surrendered only temporarily to a West African or English merchant to guarantee repayment for goods sold to the other party on credit. So English people and Europeans could also be pawns to West African creditors. I now return to epistolary form. Again, avant la lettre of its 18th century literary canonization in the novel. I'm going to cite the next passage at some length. Written in September 1681, it represents the solitary letter written by William Play in his role as interim or temporary factor at Jamesfort, the easternmost outpost of the Royal African Company. Writing to company headquarters at Cape Coast, Play reports an accounting error committed by the factor who preceded him, who came before him. What I aim to illustrate here is the most definitive characteristic of epistolary form as we know it in 18th century literary history, which is its capacity to communicate the deep interior emotion of the writer. So Play, the author, proceeds, "Though Mr. Franklin is dead, yet must needs complain of a very gross abuse he has put on me in two or three particulars of the invoice of goods he gave me at his departure. For having several times desiring him to overhaul the warehouse," overhaul is to survey, "the warehouse, he still put me off till the very instant of his departure to Cape Coast. And then he went into the warehouse in a hurry, and would not suffer me to overhaul all the goods, especially the pot keys, but made me set them down as he dictated, and he being my superior, I could not help it. So that upon the tale of them since, I find 24 less than he assured me there was. That this is true, I call the God of truth to witness, and I hope your worship will believe me, for in the presence of God, I wish I may forfeit my eternal happiness if any goods hath gone out of the warehouse more than my enclosed account makes out. God that knows the secrets of my soul knows my innocence too, and I hope your worship will not suffer me to come to any damage where I am guiltless through the unequal dealings of my superior, since I never yet did wrong to any man, but will still make it my great endeavor to answer your worship's goodness to me in my diligence and fidelity as long as I live. The obsequious tone of this letter reflects the absolute prerogative enjoyed by the Royal African Company. Play, the author, defers to the company's royalist administrative hierarchy, as well as his ultimate superior, the RAC Agent General, located at Cape Coast, who possessed the power to discipline or incarcerate insubordinate employees. The invoice of goods, tally or tale, and enclosed account Play submits for inspection represent the defining element of the enslaver's archive in the sphere of mercantile exchange. Most crucially, because this trading sphere was not regulated by any state-issued currency, the letter writer must offer detailed narrative descriptions of the value of RAC goods. Such descriptions refer to warehoused items held in storage, as well as the conditions that define the variable worth of English commodities as they are exchanged for African goods at the particular moment the trade occurs. Designated by anthropologist William Peets, a mercantile cross-cultural space of transvaluation between material objects of radically different social orders. The trading scene documented by RAC factors evokes in epistolary form the circulatory transvaluations of goods, including captive people, on the West African coast. So returning to Play's letter, I wish to stress its striking formal resemblance to a literary epistle whose signal or central capacity is the communication of feeling. The affective immediacy of the first person letter, again known as writing to the moment, is elucidated by Richardson in the preface to his novel, Clarissa. The letters are written while the hearts of the writers must be supposed to be wholly engaged in their subjects, so that they abound not only with critical situations, but with what may be called instantaneous descriptions and reflections, which may be brought home to the breast of the youthful reader. The likeness between Play's letter and Richardson's evocation of epistolary form resides in instantaneous descriptions and reflections located as close as possible to the real time of the correspondent's act of writing. It is the central attributes of instantaneity, immediacy of reference, and spontaneous expression of affect and reflection that affirm the likeness of the RAC archive to the Richardsonian letter. We can thus appreciate the formal devices through which Play defends himself against the charge of embezzling or stealing company fabric. To declare my innocence, Play exploits the capacity of the first person epistle to represent his own interior depth. He invokes his impassioned interiority to assert the virtue of the secrets of my soul. Only in the medium of first-person narrative form can this factor claim to reveal the truth of his own soul, thus communicating internal secrets that the letter form claims to authorize as true. And yet, a profound paradox accompanies my alignment of Play's letter with Richardson's vision of an epistolary form through which ethical sentiments are brought home to the breast of the youthful reader. This paradox is most acutely exposed by the theorist Hortense Spillers, who offers the following characterization of what is absent from the historical archive of the European trade in enslaved African persons. In this archive, Spillers discovers reference neither to the subjectivity of the enslaved person nor to the subjectivity of the person who enslaves. Expecting to find direct and amplified reference, the observer is disappointed time and again that this cultural subject is concealed beneath the mighty debris of the itemized account, between the lines of the massive logs of commercial enterprise. Such obscene, inveterate blindness might be denied point blank as a possibility for anyone, except that we know it happened. Richardson's hearts, wholly engaged with their subjects, are absent from an archive where the subject of slavery fails to move the enslaver's heart. For it is not only the subject of the enslaved person that the historical archive represses. Also absent is the subject of the perpetrator, whose obscene, inveterate blindness Spillers claims as the enabling condition of a textual history comprised of massive logs and account books. I mean to make a related but somewhat discrepant suggestion about the RAC letters. This is that the blindness for which Spillers indicts the enslaver's archive becomes inescapably manifest by virtue of these first-person letters' form. When compared to a Richardsonian epistle in which humanizing sentiment is brought home to the breast of the reciprocally humanized reader, the form of Play's missive foregrounds his own radically circumscribed ethical or humanizing agency as the radically circumscribed ethical or humanizing agency of the letter, he writes. So we are now poised to appreciate how this factor fuses his claim of innocence to his formal articulation of the truth of his warehouse tally. Play calls upon the God of truth to witness his innocence, because God, operating as an omniscient witness, can penetrate the depths of Play's soul, thereby collapsing Play's epistolary declaration of truth and its divine guarantee. And yet, a grotesque irony emerges from Play's appeal to the soul-penetrating God whose omniscience would vindicate his innocence. This God appears to surveil the sphere of mercantile bookkeeping only. Critically, Play insists to his Royal African Company superior that I never yet did wrong to any man. Therefore, when he invokes God to affirm that he never yet wronged any man, Play excludes from the theater of divine judgment the wrongs he has committed against West African man, those persons he has enslaved and trafficked. Play's God would find Play guiltless because he has not stolen company fabric. According to his own vows of divinely sanctioned innocence, Play's enslavement of captive African people does not expose him to divine judgment. Play is so confident that his God will not condemn him for trafficking in slaves that when he attests his innocence of stealing company fabric, he invokes his assurance of his own heavenly destiny. In the presence of God, I wish I may forfeit my eternal happiness. Here we encounter an even excessive illustration of the obscene, inveterate blindness with which Spillers indicts the archive. It is not only Play, but also Play's Christian God, who appears oblivious to the ethical atrocities of the slave trade. Play solicits God's soul-penetrating omniscience to vindicate his formal exposure of the secrets of his soul. In so doing, Play restricts this God to the mandate of policing the balance sheet of Royal African Company warehouse stores. Concerning the formal mechanism of Play's appeal to divine judgment, I mean to suggest two things. First, Play's claim that he never yet did wrong to any man typifies the abridgment of the category of the human, or man, evidenced in the enslaver's archive, as condemned by Spillers. Second, because Play exploits the letter to plumb the depths of his own righteousness, epistolary form amplifies the magnitude of this abridgment. The letter form animates Play's sentimental ethical capacity, his references to his soul and heart, only to expose their egregiously circumscribed interests. In other words, the form of the letter exposes the depth of the blindness evoked by Spillers, not as pure absence, but as the manifest foreclosure of the epistle's capacity to communicate first-person sentiment as humanizing or ethical feeling. And yet, "It would be inaccurate of me to suggest that the Royal African Company letters contain no feeling at all. We do find the letter form exercised to communicate affect. But such first-person effusions of strong emotion serve only to aggravate or even exceed Spiller's critique. For example, a factor writing from the RAC fort in Sekondi in Ghana attests, 'I am most intolerably troubled with rats in the warehouse. They now begin to damnify the goods, I having found several things gnawed per them. I know not what to do with the rats. They damage so much goods that would make one mad to see, especially the woolen goods. They eat holes in the boisados, Welch planes, and blankets that I can run my fist in them.'" What renders this writer intolerably troubled and even mad to see is not the shackling, sale, and trafficking of West African captives. Rather, his letter evokes the depth of his trouble and madness in the face of rats who damage or damnify company fabrics stored in his warehouse. We are thus prepared for an even more striking instance of epistolary affect elicited by the writer's trade in captive persons. That's that up here. "One thing grieves me very much. That is, I am forced to sell one Negro to provide for the rest." This man may use the letter form to express his grief, but in a clear break with the Richardsonian epistle, such grief claims no ethical or humanitarian provenance. What provokes the factor's grief is not the abject circumstances of the persons whom he sells, or the person whom he sells, but rather the fact that he must exchange one captive for food in order to sustain the rest. Under these circumstances, we encounter an entirely divergent mandate for the capacity of the letter form to communicate the writer's feeling. His feeling does not demonstrate his sentimental, ethical, or humanizing consciousness, but rather the depth of his concern for the subsistence of the commodities under his care, commodities that include the physiological bodies of enslaved persons. On the terrain of methodology, I mean to argue that by contrast with the literary historical canonization of epistolary novels as the site of humanizing interiority or consciousness, the RAC writer's expressions of feeling expose a divergent genealogy of the letter form. Here, the epistolary I and its attendant effusions of affect or appeals to omniscient knowledge are used to facilitate the circulatory transvaluation of goods and commoditized captives. I now turn to the African-American scholar of slavery and representation, Sadia Hartman, who has theorized the conditions through which she might attempt to imagine the selfhood of persons whose subjectivity has been effaced by the archive of slavery. Most influentially, Hartman proposes the term critical fabulation to define her effort to tell impossible stories of enslaved persons whose subjectivity is not represented in the historical archive. In the context of the RAC letters, I mean to amplify an aspect of Hartman's method that has not received a lot of attention. This is Hartman's engagement with the narratological theory of Mieke Ball, from which Hartman devises the term critical fabulation. As Hartman states, fabula denotes the building blocks of the narrative. Through an intervention in the texture of the fabula that subsist in logbooks and company accounts, Hartman projects the subversive potential of critical fabulation as a speculative projection of history beyond and in excess of the archive of slavery. And Hartman writes, "By playing with and rearranging the basic elements of the story, by representing the sequence of events in divergent stories and from contested points of view, I have attempted to jeopardize the status of the event, to displace the received or authorized account, and to imagine what might have happened or what might have been said or might have been done." Hartman focuses here on the narrative articulation of story. her effort to jeopardize the status of the event of enslavement implicates the generic parameters of realist representation, whereby the fabula or building blocks of the narrative solicit description through an infranarrative logic that Mieke Bal designates motivation in realist novels. Motivation determines what elements in the fabula attract the narrative gaze. This gaze may be solicited from characters within novels whose capacity to act as vectors of narrative description Bal justifies in a very particular way. The character must have both the time to look and a reason to look at the object. Hence, the curious characters, the men of leisure, the unemployed, and the Sunday strollers. And a great example here is Père Goriot. Those of you who read Balzac's novel, the gaze is motivated from a student who has time to look. From the perspective of the archive of slavery, we can appreciate the bias built into this normative articulation of realism from its very building blocks. The bearers of the narrative gaze must have leisure or time to look, thus disqualifying from the stipulation of descriptive capacity persons who are not unemployed or who indeed work to the point of exhaustion. More critically, the character that describes must have a reason to look at the object, a reason that is obviously lacking in an archive of slavery that fails to represent captive Africans as anything other than commoditized bodies or numerical tallies. With this excursus into Hartman's methodology, I mean to stress that the RAC letters compel us to appreciate the divergent formal and representational parameters of the RAC archive. By dint of their form, the letters do not solicit attunement to the exclusionary motivation of the fabula, as much as they demonstrate the equally exclusionary use of a first-person epistle, whose formal mechanisms are exhausted by the writer's immediate, ceaseless, immersive recounting of the events that dictate the value of his goods at the situated instance of their exchange. The form of the RAC letters is exhaustively deployed within a sphere of circulation not regulated by state-issued currency or money, as Emmanuel Wallerstein explains. In an exchange between two economic arenas, each external to the other, currency is not used. Exchange is conducted in commodities that are inversely valued. In this capacity, the RAC letter writers must endlessly narrate mutations of circulatory value stabilized by no monetary equivalent. There's no sort of universal value. Such circulatory value requires that the factor write to the moment of the always variable worth of his goods. My trade being dull, from the time of my sending for powder to the end of the month, I took but 5 ounces of gold, and yet not above a week before they were mad for powder and cleared the Dutch of all theirs, so that my trade is such a lottery, I know not what to advise for. They are eager for a sort of goods, just as I send for them. I am not certain they will vend when they come up. Coming up is the goods coming up from Cape Coast. This writer employs the pronoun they. They were mad for powder and they are eager for a sort of goods to refer to West African merchants and their customer base, who were notoriously discriminating expert consumers of European commodities. Among the contingencies that define the mercantile market as a lottery, thus ensuring the temporal momentum of the letter form, is the expertise of West African merchants and artisanal makers whose informed judgments claim decisive influence. West African leaders, merchants, and makers determine the dynamics of valuation, the conditions of the event of trade, and the physical communication of the RAC letters. Since only West African canoe men were skilled enough to navigate the passage of the letters up and down the coast. By attending to the economic conditions that produce the RAC letters, I mean to suggest that they bestow on literary history an alternative venue for the emergence of epistolary form, one that does not produce the humanized sentiment with which scholars credit the Richardsonian epistle. By contrasting the RAC letters with this later literary historical exemplar of epistolary form, I mean to foreground the manifest blindness crystallized in the mercantile corpus. Here, the writer's impassioned self-reference and vows of interior virtue are dedicated to the task of mercantile valuation. We encounter in the RAC archive blindness amplified, one might even say produced as such, by virtue of a letter form exploited solely to represent and to try futilely to control the contingencies pervading the scene of mercantile exchange. So I cite another factor who writes, "I suppose Your Honor has been informed by Mr. Togood how the slaves would have rose upon us, but being prevented, all is well. I have, humbly begging your pardon, put on board Captain Branfill the four greatest rogues and four women, and have received in lieu thereof 170 ounces of coral, which hope will turn to better advantage, for it eats no corn, which is now dear." It is the form of this letter, I mean to argue, that makes inescapable the writer's refusal to describe durable human subjectivity to these eight fleetingly resistant persons. For while they emerge in the second sentence of the letter as subjects of realist reference, as four greatest rogues and four women, they enter the letter as slaves and leave the letter having been transmuted into the pronoun it. In the expanse of the second sentence, the writer vengefully exchanges four West African men and four West African women for 170 ounces of coral. He himself plays on the haunting semantic remainder of an it that no longer must eat. Here, I do not denounce the writer's personal ethical failure, though this is certainly obvious, but rather argue that it is the letter form that renders such ethical failure flagrantly manifest. RAC factors right to the moment of the ceaseless variables that determine circulatory value on the West African coast. As their letters move through time and space to ascribe value to one good in terms of another, they show how the circulatory impetus of mercantile exchange coexists with the dehumanizing valuation of West African life. I have now upwards of 50 slaves in the fort, which eats a chest of corn every day, and I cannot get any for money here. I had almost forgot to entreat Your Honor that above all things to send down 10 pair of strong irons, and 20 or 30 pair of short irons. For this day I have borrowed of the Dutchman, and some paper, for I tear my books for this, some iron wedges and mauls to cleave rocks. In this letter, 50 captive people are subjected to the quantifying violence whereby they become a singular witch that is further reduced to the value of a chest of corn. The valuation of the latter good as money, a word that signified gold in the company's trading argo, remains to be determined. Here, I mean to underscore the fact that this passage explicitly places in relation irons or shackles and paper, for I tear my books for this. The materiality of the epistolary letter inhabits the same circulatory matrix as the tools of enslavement. I will rephrase my argument while these itemized particulars remain in view. The historical conditions for this genealogy of epistolary form are mercantilism and enslavement. My ultimate suggestion can be simply stated. These letters and the physical matrix that produces them are part of English literary history. Part two. As we have seen with a letter that implicates people, irons, and the paper on which the traitor's epistle is written, the RAC archive enmeshes the bodies of goods, people, and the letter itself in a circulatory mercantile matrix. I now shift focus to discuss an aspect of credit and debt relations in the sphere of West African trade that has not been considered in literary critical accounts of slavery's archive. This is the particular situation experienced by bonded free people who serve as pawns, or gages, defined as a legal category of social and economic dependency in which a person is held as collateral for a loan. As temporarily bonded persons, pawns accrue value within the matrix of mercantile credit relations, but they are not irredeemably dehumanized or commoditized. The RAC letters therefore track the variable status of persons whose bondage may be reversed. Through the figure of the pawn, the letters expose to view the residual or recuperable humanity of the bonded person, which may sometimes extend to other actors in the RAC archive, whom I do not have time to discuss today. It's actually a very complicated scene, including remunerated paid company slaves or hired and coerced West African laborers. The letter from which I now cite was written by the Royal African Company factor located at Komenda in the West African state of Iguafo in present-day Ghana after the factory was attacked by Agafo cabochiers, or chiefs. The word cabochiers comes from the Portuguese cabochera, or head. The factor proposes a diplomatic option for a truce negotiated by a local West African man employed by the company, whose name is Captain Bracken. So this is, if your honor inclines to keep the place, it will not be amiss to send up to Agwafo desiring gold pawns for the future security of the Royal Company's factory, or else such men pawns as shall be approven of by Captain Bracken. The goods for which Bracken remains debtor are 10 chest sheets, 4 barrels powder, 13 pieces perpetuanos, and 15 pieces seis. If your honor shall please to order me down before Bracken can come along with me to give satisfaction for the goods sold by him, he proffers to send his chief wife with me to remain till he comes himself. This passage cites multiple instances of pawnship, instantiated by gold as well as by men and a wife, to demonstrate that human bondage may guarantee military détente as well as English-issued lines of credit. Typical of the vertiginous transvaluation of goods and persons that the RAC letters narrate, we learn that Bracken is not only a West African hired by the Royal African Company to translate and negotiate with local cabochiers. Bracken is also a small merchant who has been granted company credit to purchase English fabrics and gunpowder. As a guarantee against this extension of English credit, Bracken offers to convert his own chief wife into a pawn until he can pay his debt at company headquarters in person. Bracken is not only the company's employee, but also its debtor. His double status demonstrates the critical role of pawnship in sustaining English grants of credit, whose profound structural impact on local and transatlantic African society has been summarized by one historian as European financing of the Africans' engagement with the Atlantic. Pawns were not slaves. Neither their persons nor their labor could be converted into debt or interest payments. To elaborate this point, I cite a relatively rare moment in the RAC archive when the letter writer provides a political justification for the slave status of the persons whom they purchase from West African merchants. "I hope you have received the woman slave that I sent your worship. The current here, or African leader, desires you would not suffer her on any account to be redeemed. She hath much disobliged him, he says, till I can tell not otherwise, but believe it is murder she hath committed. Critically, this writer rationalizes the English commoditization and trafficking of this West African woman by virtue of anterior slave status already dictated by her local leader. It is this woman's prior condition as the slave of her West African courantier that constitutes the warrant for her ongoing enslavement and transportation to the English colonies. Notably, the English factor hazards supplemental justification by citing this woman's criminality. I believe it is murder she hath committed. Here the factor provides a speculative political rationale for the fact that this woman's enslavement cannot be bought out or redeemed. In a more typical scenario, English traders understood enslavement within West Africa to be reversible. That's the same quote. The slave that I wrote your worship about was redeemed by some of the Wassas, who gave the Adams a bendy for his redemption before the said snap pans came on shore, and with the said money, bought part of the snap pans at 8 per bendy. That's that quote. A nameless slave, owned by members of the Adam kingdom, is bought back or redeemed by Ghanaian Wassa people with gold or money. This person's subsequent disappearance from the company archive foregrounds another difference between commoditized slavery and pawnship. Pawns were not stripped of their names and subjected to the extreme vulnerability of ruptured kin ties or kinlessness that is evident in both passages I cite here. Instead, often elevated kinship ties were crucial to the pawn's sustenance of debt or diplomatic security. The prominence of the pawn's social status enhanced the force of the pawnship agreement, ideally protecting the pawn from abduction. So for the purposes of our literary historical appraisal of the RIC archive, I will further consider the difference of enslaved persons from pawns. This difference was not always stable, but we can appreciate its structural role in an account replicated in the Rawlinson copybook. So this is a picture from the Bodleian. In this tally from James Fort in October 1681, the list headed company pawns up there comes before an account of slaves belonging to the company. The first person named as a pawn claims an especially notable presence in the archive. And that's the first name there. Bokeh is the wife of Ansa, or Hanisa, the king of the state of Akwama, so the king's wife, who engaged in regional military conquest to engross inland trade with the Royal African Company. Bokeh has been pawned for 100 muskets. So you can see it lists the muskets there. For 100 muskets purchased by Ansa on company credit. She was released or delivered in July 1683 when Ansa repaid his debt. As the inventory's facing page shows, so this is the prior page, you can see, both pawns and slaves are classified under the heading of RAC goods. Subsisting in the account book as debt security, Bokeh and the three named canoe men, who likewise have been made pawns, they're listed below her, they qualify as company goods, but not as company slaves. Only the latter persons occupy the kinless status of persons who may immediately be converted into circulatory value, while the pawns embody value still attached to their names, their kin status, their occupation, and relational ties. The pawn animates a metaphysical particularity, rigorously definitive of this place and time. At the crux of the nascent abstraction of credit, but wedded to the concreteness of the named and situated body, the legitimacy of any given act of pawnship had to be affirmed by both English and West African parties. as a figure of English value, not reducible to numerical abstraction, whose bodily materiality is mutually credited by African and English parties, the pawn nonetheless proves amenable to the logic of the company account book, operating as a conduit for the diffusion of company credit requisite to restructure the African and African Atlantic world. Because of the social power of African creditors and their capacity to disrupt regional trade or switch allegiances, especially to the Dutch, who were competing with the English at this time, the Royal African Company was under significant pressure to accept pawns from West African merchants as human securities. If a factor did not grant such credit, their trading station might collapse. As historian Anthony Kia writes, in spite of the frequency of default, these demands for goods on credit could not easily be ignored. Ralph Hassell, the beleaguered and impolitic factor of Charles Fort, a company settlement in Fante territory, writes of his hostile conference with the Fante Cabuchiers, I told them that I could not take pawns, knowing that they do not care to redeem them, and that for several years Mr. Thelwall had pawns from several of them, and that time the Royal Company's money lay dead. 10 days later, Hassell reports a total breakdown. This day, about 2 hours since, I have had a great discourse and long debate with the Cabuchiers, and the result is they will not again accept of Ralph Hazel, he having spoiled the country by his refusing to take Fantine Craw-Craw, which is nothing but mere brass, and that he will not trust them nor take their pawns. In conclusion, I return to the matter of the letter form. It is striking that when Hassell initially reports that I could not take pawns, he occupies his letter in the default epistolary position of the first person narrator. But when he writes to inform his superiors that he has been rebuked by local West Fante leaders or Cabuchiers, Hassell refers to himself in the third person. They will not again accept of Ralph Hazel. Hassell avoids the self-reference inherent to the letter form when he explains that the Fante leaders condemn his violation of trade relations, epitomized by his refusal of the local currency, Kra-Kra, and his refusal to accept pawns. Can we connect the collapse of credit relations caused by the rejected pawn to the formal mutation of Hassell's narration of this event? I mean to suggest that the pawn exists in the epistolary archive as something other than the site of preemptively racialized or unilateral dehumanization. Indeed, Hassell writes from the midst of negotiations at another factory, the last quote, they bind me to stay as a pawn till the bearer of this letter return. Here we encounter Hassell's first-person narration of his own entrance into bondage. By virtue of the mutual investment of African and English value in African or English pawns, Hassell's letter, if only for the temporary duration of this sentence, marks a site of crossover whereby an English writer animates the subjective position of the bonded person. In the case of pawnship, the RAC letter does not categorically oppose epistolary selfhood to the writer's occupancy of bondage or other compromised subjective states. Hassell demonstrates the capacity of the letter to animate bondage and subjectivity as mutual states of human consciousness. And yet, as we know, this capacity was not historically realized for West African people. Most graphically in this instance, the RAC letter's form amplifies its denial of humanity to enslaved West African persons. Only when they are considered as a constitutive part of English literary history can we appreciate the blindness of the archive manifest in the form of the Royal African Company letters. The end.
Thank you.